Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Today we'll look at the betrayal of America's citizens by the liberal institutions that were supposed to protect us. We'll hear from journalists Chris Hedges and David Lindorf. And to lighten the mood a bit, a couple of songs by Fred Eaglesmith. I hope you'll stay tuned. Do you ever feel sort of, you know, betrayed? Of course. Everybody is feeling betrayed. Except maybe the war machine and Goldman Sachs. Betrayed by the institutions that we were told would protect us. For years I felt that I have so many knives sticking out of my back, they're going to have trouble finding a spot to stick the next one in. Don't worry, they'll find one. I'll never make it through the airport metal detector. I still remember one day when I was a teenager, say 1965, taking the Pennsylvania Railroad commuter train from my blue-collar town into Philadelphia. Just poking around Center City, checking out the free library, the Franklin Institute, the pretzel vendors, and some guy on a corner offers me a copy of some socialist paper. Maybe it was the Weekly People. I read it on the train back home, and I still remember one part of it. It was a political cartoon. It showed a fat cat labor leader and a fat cat capitalist, dressed to the nines, waltzing together in a grand ballroom. The dialogue went something like, "You take the lead, Alphonse. No, you take the lead, Gaston." In my teenage wisdom, I thought the charge preposterous. Who could imagine big labor being in bed with big business? Ridiculous. Now, there have been many admirable exceptions among the unions. For instance, the auto workers under Walter Reuther. But by now I can see that the Weekly People had gotten it fairly right. Big labor did hurt its members by getting far too cozy with the corporate owners. Labor should have seen the corporate bigwigs as their adversaries, not their partners in progress. The corporate bigwigs had a clearer understanding of who their adversaries were and acted accordingly. For the most part, I try not to grumble like this in public, so as not to bore or depress what listeners I may have. But my favorite journalist prophet, Chris Hedges, has just come out with a new book on the same theme, and I've seen the video of a nice lecture he gave based on the book. The book is called The Death of the Liberal Class. Hedges talks about six institutions that once served as a safety valve for the system. Six institutions that once allowed reform from within the system. Six institutions that used to mitigate the rampage and destruction you get when the powerful economic interests start stampeding over the rest of us. By now, says Chris Hedges, these six institutions have all sold out. They've said, if you can't beat 'em, join 'em. Or maybe, join 'em, that's where the money is. Six institutions that have quit being the loyal opposition and have become simply collaborators, leaving the citizens with no protection inside the system. It's an interesting sextet. Yes, one is organized labor, but that's not the worst. Others are universities, culture, and the liberal church, Episcopalians and the like. And then the two that are the most egregious, the most infuriating, the ones who have struck the longest, broadest knives into the backs of the poor, the working class, and the middle-class citizens. These are the press and the Democratic Party. There's not time for all six today. Now that the elections are over, I think we can discuss the Democrats without sounding partisan. We'll hear Hedges discussing these, courtiers, he politely calls them. Then we'll hear from Philadelphia journalist David Lindorf on the failures of the Democratic Party's most prominent national leader. Let's start with Chris Hedges on the betrayal of the people by the Democrats, for the interests of the ruling oligarchy.
The problem is that with the march of the corporate state, the rise of the corporate state, which began with Reagan in earnest, with the deregulation and the destruction of antitrust laws, was accelerated by Bill Clinton, certainly the greatest traitor to the American working class ever produced by the Democratic Party. Clinton understood that if he did corporate bidding in terms of structuring the economy, he could get corporate money. He understood, or he thought, that workers and unions had nowhere else to go. They'd have to vote Democratic anyway. And so Clinton's conscious goal was to attract corporate money and carry out, in return, the passage of draconian legislation, which has thrust a knife into the back of the American working class. NAFTA, 1994. The Welfare Reform Act, 1996. The Financial Services Modernization Act of 1999. You know, Canada doesn't have a banking crisis because Canada didn't remove the firewalls between commercial and investment banks. They didn't allow local banks to become hedge funds. And in return, corporations began to give money to the Democratic Party, so that by the 1990s, the Democrats had fundraising parity with the Republicans. Now, this essentially killed the liberal class, because traditional liberal values, both in terms of a defense of civil liberties, a defense of the working class, a belief that those who had fallen on hard times, whether unemployed or others, should be given resources to help them sustain themselves in times of difficulty, they spoke, continued to speak in this language, but were carrying out ruthless policies, which was creating immense amounts of suffering in the very constituencies that they claimed to defend. And I think that when you look at that shift among the working class, which really moved en masse away from the Democratic Party, one can see an immense erosion following NAFTA. And so we end up with a Democratic Party that speaks in a voice of such flagrant hypocrisy that it has killed its own credibility. Look at the elections of 2006, when the Democrats sought to retake control of the Congress, which they did. They campaigned primarily on an anti-war message against the war in Iraq. And what did they do when they took power? They not only continued to fund the war, but increased troop levels in Iraq by 30,000. The reforms that have been instituted by the Democratic Party are so alien to the rhetoric that the mechanism, that safety valve, which can make a capitalist democracy function, has essentially been turned shut. So that now, with the creation of a kind of permanent underclass, and even Lawrence Summers, you know, acknowledges this when he talks about a jobless recovery, the inability on the part of working men and women to get access to credit, you know, they keep prolonging unemployment benefits because, courtesy of Bill Clinton, once unemployment benefits run out, people are going to have to try and live on the $143 a month they receive from welfare. So the anger that we are seeing expressed throughout the society, through the Tea Party, through militias, through the Christian right, which I'm going to speak about in a minute, comes with a two-pronged attack. One is against the power elite, which is for them defined as Washington. One of the most interesting aspects of the Tea Party movement is the way Dick Armory, with corporate money, went into the movement and made sure that the anger was deflected from Wall Street and directed towards government, with not very subtle undertones of overt racism. And the other prong of the attack is against the liberal class, hatred for the liberal class. And I would argue that this hatred is not misplaced, that the hatred for the liberal class is deserved, because the liberal class, and especially the sort of progressive wing of the Democratic Party, did traditionally watch out for the interests of the working class. And for money, for corporate money, they sold workers out, and of course now the middle class. And so you can watch it with Obama. I mean, if you look at the Obama administration, there is, on any substantial issue, virtually no difference from an administration run by John McCain. I mean, the tragedy for me of the Obama administration is that the Democrats, once they took power, essentially codified the destruction of domestic and international law that had been carried out by the Bush administration. The Democrats couldn't even find it within themselves to restore habeas corpus. I was part of the ACLU lawsuit against the government for the FISA Reform Act. The FISA Reform Act was pushed through Congress to essentially make legal retroactively what was illegal. And that was the warrantless wiretapping and eavesdropping, as well as storage of email, phone messages of tens of millions of Americans. We had 30 cases working our way up through the lower courts against Verizon and AT&T for turning this information over to the government in direct violation of our constitutional rights. And those cases would have won. And those telecommunication companies knew it. And so what did they do? They went to Washington with millions of dollars, much of which they handed off to Democratic congressmen, including Senator Obama. And Obama, although during the campaign, had promised that he would filibuster the FISA Reform Act, went and voted for it. The continuation of our doomed imperial project in Iraq, the escalation of the war in Afghanistan, which you don't hear this from the New York Times, we're losing, and we're losing the war badly, the looting of the U.S. Treasury on the behalf of Wall Street, all of this was begun by the Bush administration, but continued and embraced by the Obama administration, by the Democratic Party. And I think if there's probably no better example of how utterly bankrupt our liberal establishment has become than by looking at everything the Obama administration has carried out, including abandoning a commitment to protect a woman's right to choose, including abandonment of a public option. The so-called health care reform bill is essentially just the equivalent to the pharmaceutical, the for-profit pharmaceutical and insurance industry of the bank bailout bill, $400 billion in subsidies. They can still raise co-payments and premiums. They're getting all sorts of exemptions because companies like Aetna don't want to be forced to provide medical coverage to sick children. It's legally permitted now in this country for for-profit insurance companies to hold sick children hostage while their parents frantically bankrupt themselves to try and save their sons or daughters. Any honest discussion of health care would acknowledge the fact that our for-profit health care system is the problem and must be destroyed. But that will never happen. It won't happen because the industry's money and lobbyists drive the discussion, both on the airwaves with the courtiers who function as pundits and analysts, as well as within the political process itself, which is why you had Dennis Kucinich during the Democratic primary standing literally in a snowbank in New Hampshire because he would not be invited into the room. The for-profit healthcare companies actually sponsored the debate in Iowa, which, of course, they were not going to give a figure like Kucinich and much less Ralph Nader a position. These kinds of critiques, and frankly, this kind of truth, was something that corporations and the corporate media consciously locked out of the debate. And the liberal class was complicitous, completely complicitous. The danger when a liberal class breaks down is that there becomes no mechanism anymore by which mounting rage and anger can be expressed within the system.
When I met her, she was a beauty queen who wanted something more. And now she's hanging out with me in front of the liquor store. And it won't start when I shut it off, so she has to get the beer. She puts it in the back seat and she quietly says to me, oh, when exactly did we become white trash? How come we got seven dogs living in the garage? How come the only 8-track in our car is Johnny Cash? When exactly did we become like trash? And she tells all our friends that I've got my PhD, but it stands for post-hole digger. It ain't exactly a degree. And there's curtains on the windows, and we hardly watch TV. And that double wide is triple wide now that she's with me. And she says, when exactly did we become white trash? How come we got seven dogs who burned down the grass? How come the only A-track in our car is Johnny Cash? When exactly did we become white trash? Girl, when exactly did we become...
Fred Eaglesmith with another of his patented comic yet sympathetic sketches of life in the lower working class. At least the white, rural version of life in the lower working class. Now that we've had some comic relief, let's have some gloom and doom from David Lindorf. This was published in Counterpunch, October 15. Don't Act, Don't Lead by Dave Lindorf. Candidate Barack Obama, running for president, vowed to end the ludicrous Pentagon policy of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which has required gay and lesbian members of the uniformed services to hide their sexual orientation or be drummed out of the service. In 2009, just installed in the White House, President Obama reiterated that the policy, quote, doesn't contribute to our national security, unquote. Now a federal judge has ruled the policy to be unconstitutional and has issued an injunction barring the Pentagon from enforcing it. And the president has responded, not by letting the court order stand, but by appealing the decision in an attempt to reverse it. Here again, the president is following his own pathetic political policy of don't act, don't lead. Cowed by opposition from his own defense secretary and from the generals, Obama has kicked the can down the road yet again. Why should we be surprised? This is classic Obama. Afraid of the Republicans, he gave us half an economic stimulus plan back in 2009. As a consequence, today we have an official unemployment rate of 9.7% and an unofficial real unemployment rate of double that. Afraid of the banking lobby, he gave us a bank reform bill that leaves the too-big-to-fail banks even bigger and more dominant than they were when they brought the financial system crashing down back in 2008. Afraid of the insurance industry, the pharmaceutical industry, and the physician lobbies, he gave us a health care reform bill that will raise insurance costs for almost everyone, do little to slow the rise in health care costs for the nation, cause many employers to drop coverage of their employees, and that will still leave tens of millions of Americans without health insurance. Afraid of the Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, and other business groups, he dropped all efforts to pass any kind of climate change legislation. Afraid of the oil industry, he has lifted a brief moratorium on deep-sea drilling, even as the hidden damage caused by the BP blowout in the Gulf of Mexico continues to be slowly exposed by scientists. And afraid of being called soft on terrorism, he failed to shut down the ongoing atrocities of the Guantanamo and Bagram prisons, and has continued to permit the detention of people without any charge. Given these monumental acts of political cowardice, is it any wonder that Obama has been unwilling to put an end to the overt discrimination of don't ask, don't tell, even when the opportunity was handed to him on a silver platter by a federal judge? The president once wrote a book called The Audacity of Hope. What a joke! Any hope that this administration will do the right thing on almost any issue is vain. And as for audacity, the president doesn't know the meaning of the word. So ends journalist and essayist David Lindorf. Lindorf has created a handy catalog of the Democratic administration's betrayal of the American people. but I have to disagree strongly on one point. In July, we did a New World Notes installment titled, It's Not Character Flaws, It's Policy. I think Lindorf is making this mistake, and I think Chris Hedges and I are on the same side here. Lindorf perceives a character flaw in Obama. He's afraid. He's afraid of the generals, afraid of the Republicans, afraid of big finance, afraid of the oil industry, and so on. I don't buy this. Obama isn't afraid. He's the tool and the servant of these powerful economic interests. He's doing, brilliantly, just what they selected him to do, what they are paying him to do. As Hedges notes, all the major policies of Obama's government are identical to Bush's, which were identical to Clinton's, which were identical to Reagan's, and you can go back as far as you like, at least to Truman. Chris Hedges concludes his speech with the thought that we will never regain democracy and general prosperity through electoral politics. The only hope is for the people to get together, to organize, to fight back, nonviolently, one hopes, to scare our rulers into making concessions out of fear of a massive revolt of the bottom 99% of us. That's what got us the New Deal under Roosevelt in the 1930s. That's what got us the great liberal domestic reforms under Nixon in the 1970s.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street, and there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. Damn it. My life has value. So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore! I want you to get up right now. Get up, go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore! Things have got to change now. Go to
where
the
are
window.
You going? Who wants to think he's yelling?
Window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, and keep yelling, I'm
mad as hell! How am I going to take this anymore?
That sounds like a long shot, and it is. But we have to at least try to do something. As Wordsworth urged us in his poem, do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Nonviolently, if at all possible. Here's another Fred Eaglesmith song that captures my feelings about the Democratic Party. And I dedicate this song to the Democratic Party.
There were 17 cars out of my backyard. The boys in blue are calling my name. Semi-automatics up on the rooftop. They just wanted to talk to me. I tell them what they wanted to hear. The only thing that I knew, fought a diesel locomotive couldn't drag me back to you. Everywhere you go, there's a train wreck, babe. Everywhere you go, there's a runaway train. Break my heart like a bottleneck, babe. Sliding up and down, I'm pulling each train. Everywhere you go, everybody knows you're looking for someone to do. 49 times a day's a locomotive couldn't drag me back to you. 49 times a day's a locomotive couldn't drag me back to you.
Thanks for listening. In the past half hour, you've heard many bad things said about the Democratic Party. Please do not construe that as implying anything good about the Republican Party. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. I condensed both the Hedges talk and the Lindorf essay for radio. You'll find links to the uncut version of each on the show's website. There you'll also find my email address, should you care to get in touch, more information, pretty pictures, and a good deal more. The address is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. That's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Now I get to my non-carborundum, and hope to see you again next week. Ciao!
If I was a brakeman, if I was a switchman, if I was an engineer, I'd take this train on down that line and clear on out of here. If I was the man swinging the lantern, I'd swing it till it was blue. 49 times a diesel locomotive couldn't drag me back to you. 49 times a diesel locomotive couldn't drag me back to you. 49 times a diesel locomotive.